know, Steve has to say about all the mathematical stuff we're doing and how we can, like I said, production scale this kind of work.
Thanks, Jim. Well, in fact, that's actually an excellent introduction to what I wanted to talk about, because as you'll probably guess from the content of the talk, it's a little bit of a change in focus from some of the details of the implementations to a slightly broader focus on how these kind of technologies can be captured in a way that is scalable to both a community of people who can work on common code bases, but also can translate into, hopefully even to clinical usable products. So first I just wanted to mention that it is a very large combination of efforts that I'm going to report about, and fortunately haven't probably mentioned everybody, but I'll try and highlight things as I go along. It's a big group effort. So today I'm going to give you a little bit of a sense of what the software infrastructure is that we've been working with, and then why we chose it. Give you a little bit of more concrete detail on how to develop this software for modularity and extensibility, how you might actually be able to make use of it in your own work, and then give some examples of some large-scale computing population analysis studies, and then delve a little bit more into how things are organized, why they're organized the way they are, and how you can get involved if you're interested. So first, just a little bit of a definition. It's sort of a catch-all term here, large-scale computing, but in some sense, it's both about the community and the scale of the problem. So we've heard a lot about specific techniques that very, very powerful, help solve problems. One of the things that you really always find when you work on a particular problem is the need to draw on an infrastructure that has already solved a number of the core components. So you want to be able to say, okay, I don't care about reading the files, I don't care about putting the picture on the screen, I just want to be able to assume that and write this little piece of mathematics that takes me, you know, years to come up with. You want that to be reliable, well-tested, and you'd like, in general, to be able to easily scale from the few examples that you run on your own computer into a large-scale distribution. And then another critical component of this is that you would really like to be able to translate this not just from your own machine and your own few test cases, but to something that a clinical user who may not know MATLAB, may not know how to run the software that you use, but something that can plug into an environment they're already comfortable with. And then finally, I think an important part of this is building a community of people who can all speak the same language about how to solve these problems. I mean, we have a wide variety of resources from different specialties, and everybody kind of needs to be able to use a shorthand, sort of like you use a mathematical shorthand to convey very complex issues. One of the things that we've put together is really has a lot of power in it, but we call it the NAMIC kit in the context of this National Alliance for Medical Image Computing. A lot of the software existed already, and I'm just going to give you some highlights with the idea that you can follow up more on this as you're interested in it. But it's really not just about the software. A lot of it is about, you know, the training materials that go along with it, and also, almost as importantly, the methodologies that you use in order to develop this software and ensure that it's interoperable. So here's kind of a laundry list of the pieces that we've chosen. There's a lot more detail about this on the website. I'll talk a little bit about one of the aspects that I'm most involved with, the 3D slicer software, but it builds on a lot of very powerful tools that are highly reusable. I'll talk a little bit more about some of these as they come up during the context of the rest of the talk. One of the primary components that we've really had a lot of success with is the visualization toolkit, VTK. If you're not familiar with it, it would be unusual for this community not to be, but it's OpenGL-based C++ hierarchy for visualization. It's a very robust open source setup. The Insight toolkit, I also hope people are familiar with. I'll give some more detail on this, but we encourage with our sort of approach to things that this kind of a community, the mathematics imaging community, should look very carefully and consider adopting ITK as kind of the standard platform for representing algorithms and communicating them to the wider community. Another one doesn't require a lot of description in this context, but we have a graphical user interface toolkit that is also very powerful, and mainly because it is highly compatible with our visualization environment. It uses the same C++ class hierarchy, the same style of coding, and it also has very customized widgets for things like annotations on images and volume rendering and some of these things. So that's maybe unfamiliar to people. So the general process, we have adopted on kind of a larger integration scale on stuff that has been well proven by the communities in the BTK and ITK history. So the general cycle is to keep a very active and working subversion repository to really keep the core developers, there's cartoon developers down here, all working on the same code base, rather than working in isolation for months and months and months and then trying to desperately at the last minute to figure out why things diverge, to keep this process running literally on a sort of a daily or even an hourly basis. So there's automated testing tools which set up a website for tabulating the test results so that you can ensure that any change, for example, that someone checked in and only tested on Linux can actually compile on Windows or on the Mac, and get instant feedback, and usually somebody else in the community will fix that before you even noticed it was broken. The way this plays out then is that you have in this software environment the concept still of releases, and we think that's very important because we structure our training material primarily around releases, but we also have these sort of nightly and continuous builds. And in the context of close interaction with our clinical colleagues, the idea is that you can sort of get some feedback and say, oh, this thing is broken, fix the code right away, and then build them a binary that they can just install right away and test. And that can happen, in the back and forth in the matter of minutes. So just to summarize, it emphasizes cross-platform testing. We have a lot of people on different platforms. The logs and the experience that is communicated through the wiki, through the conversations, on the email exchange essentially become the design documents for this software. And because it's all done electronically, you have a traceability. You can go back and figure out, this was the key assumption that may have caused something to go off kilter. So given that that's our software environment, the 3D slicer environment is an attempt to sort of bring all that functionality to a level which is a little bit more of sort of the point-and-click end-user application level. So something that you could run on a laptop or a desktop that brings together the kind of features that a clinician or a clinical-oriented researcher can use to get their work done. We've just made a major transition from a version 2 to a version 3, and that sort of primary version number implies a very major rework. So a lot of it's not backwards compatible, but there's a lot of the same functionality in both versions. All the current activity is on this Slicer 3 version. I'll come back to this later, but it's all freely available. It's all built on open source software in a way that I'll talk about later, but it is not considered an FDA-approved medical product, and it's not ever going to really be considered a, quote, finished product. It's always going to be an evolution. And I'll again talk a little more about that later. So the version 3.2 has just been coming out, and it's the a culmination of work by a large number of groups. Now, these are funded not only through the NAMIC environment, but also through the Neuroimage Analysis Center, CF, and a number of other folks here are involved in that one, as well as the National Center for Image-Guided Therapy, which is another application area, National Alliance for Medical Image Computing, the morphometry burn and the function burn, all these and other NIH-funded efforts have gone into supporting the development of this software. And I'll point you to the slicer.org website to get more detail on some of these features and images and pointers to the documentation. Just to give you a sort of a scale measurement, so in May of 2007, the course base of this was 371,000 lines of code. As of last night, it was around 448,000 lines of code. We have a lot of active developers, as I mentioned, from different sites. So it's something that's continuing to evolve and has a pretty nice community associated with it. I'm not going to dwell a lot on the internal architecture, but I will say that it's one of the major features of this architectural redesign for version 3 was to really encapsulate the data representation independent of the algorithms that operate on it and separate those from the user interface and the renderings of those, which of course is just probably a logical thing to do, but what it enables is a few of the manipulations and approaches that I'll talk about a little bit later. So we call those three areas the medical reality markup language layer, or MRML, and that's really the data repository. And then, essentially any of the processing routines we generally call logic, and then the graphical user interface is, it includes the visualization, volume rendering, and so forth. So here's kind of an example of what we mean by a medical reality markup language environment. It really is the idea that you have multiple modalities and multiple representations that all share a common coordinate system space for image analysis. So you can actually bring together the results of many different analysis pipelines into a common representation. Here's an example which includes, for example, volumes, and these can be both images and label maps. We have representations for diffusion images, for time series images, or for label maps and probability maps. Then models mean 3D surface representations and also unstructured grids, but also then hierarchies of transforms. Right now, affine transforms are handled completely through the whole interface. Nonlinear transforms can be used for computing, but not so much for display right now. But in addition, there are a lot of additional scene data things, like where the camera locations are, what the volume rendering parameters are, what your computing parameters are, which can all be captured in this data representation, which is then unified. And that allows you to do things like one of the key applications in image-guided therapy, which would be sort of integrating brain map data with both structurally predefined data and also intraoperative data. So this picture, probably requires a little explanation. This is a little faint, but there are some outlines here from fMRI activations, for example, some results of some of Lauren's tractography clustering applied to neurosurgery. This outline represents a tumor. And then what you can see is this has actually been registered with real-time intraoperative MR. You can tell that because this is actually a flap of skin. This is the craniotomy, so this is actually the exposed surgical approach in. And the idea is that this integrated map of multimodality data is available to the surgeon in real time to make decisions about what kind of surgical approaches and what kind of excisions might be required for an individual patient. There's a lot more to this, obviously, about how nonlinear deformations of the brain during neurosurgery are accounted for, but that's kind of a good target application to think about this integrated scene description and why it's important. So given that, and thinking about that target for a bit, is the idea that now you have some algorithm that may, for example, characterize diffusion more accurately. Maybe it uses a high-dimensional image acquisition or multi-gradient diffusion acquisition, and you can calculate it, and you think you can actually get better tractography that will better illustrate crossing fibers, or you have an fMRI routine that will better localize the eloquent cortex, the part that you don't want to cut during your neurosurgery. How do you plug that in so that different groups who contribute different components can actually work together at delivering something to the clinicians? And that's what we call generally this modules idea. So I'm just going to give you kind of a quick rundown of some of our module approaches. And I mean, it's a little bit of a goofy cartoon, but I will explain this one that Jim Miller did. So he said in Slicer 2, in an earlier versions, you basically had to learn to pole vault in order to like add your code into the core. And that now with this new architecture, you can just sort of, instead step over this little rock or trip over it. But, that's the intent of that little cartoon, is that we really have tried to make it simple and more powerful to contribute algorithms into this environment. So when we talk about a module, essentially what we're talking about is something that has, some core functionality. It's integrated into the environment by having a menu entry so user can select it and pull it up. And it also has a panel of user interface controls. And those are sort of the core elements of it. There are two different types that we've defined. So one we call interactive modules. These are actually more complicated because they are allowed to interact with the graphical user interface and the rendering. So a module, for example, that does volume rendering, or a module that does something that responds as you move the mouse, a little more complicated, those are interactive modules. A lot of activity, though, and this applies to a lot of the NAMIC core activities, probably to a lot of the work here, can be embedded in what we call command line modules, and these essentially are executables, right? Something that you would think of that you could execute at a prompt or run as part of a script, and things like registration, filtering, tractography, a lot of things actually fit nicely into that framework. So essentially, the either type of these are dynamic and sort of discovered at runtime. So the idea is that you can start with a core distribution of Slicer and then just plug in however many modules you need for the particular goal for that installation. An image-guided therapy system may not need anything from finite element domain and vice versa, so it's nice to be able to sort of mix and match the pieces that you need. So I'll just give you a little bit of detail on how these command line modules work of different types. So one of the core ways, going back to this idea of MIRML logic and GUI, is that by segmenting your code base into sort of these different parts, you can reuse a lot of the functionality in different ways and sort of focus your efforts. So this is actually some work that Killian Pohl and Brad Davis have done to bring the expectation maximization framework that Killian's developed into the Slicer 3 framework. It has a wizard front end that allows you to sort of assemble your tissue categories, say what inputs you're going to use, assign these various parameters and probabilities, and actually run experiments interactively and choose what works well for your data. But the exact same configuration of MIRML and logic can be applied directly to the command line interface version of this, something that runs just in a regular terminal. And in that, you can actually bring the parameters that you decided from one or a couple cases you did interactively and then apply those to a broad category or big group of people. So here's just a kind of a rundown, a laundry list. I won't go through all these, but there are a whole variety of tools that have already been cast into this command line module framework. They are, a lot of them, just sort of easy, simple command lines created from ITK code classes that already existed. Some of them are more sophisticated and pulled together from other code bases. There's a nice suite of registration tools. I left out one other, which is a diffeomorphic daemons that was recently made available through ITK that is apparently quite popular. And then there's a suite of diffusion tools as well. And again, these are all examples of things that have cast into this framework I'm going to tell you about just now for command line modules. So a couple things to just point out. On the Nitric website, which is the neuroinformatics tools and resources clearinghouse, there is a project which is Slicer 3 Examples, which is a whole set of example modules that are kind of a framework you could copy from here. And then also on our training website, Sonia Pujol has put together a whole step-by-step tutorial about how to write these and what the conventions are, how to structure your CMake files and so forth. But just to give you a flavor for it, the idea is that everything is sort of expressed in terms of these XML descriptions of the parameters, both input and output, for your command line module. So there's a language for expressing what we considered sort of the core elements of these kind of medical image computing tasks. So things like images that can be either scalar, label, tensor, diffusion-weighted, vector, model-based, things like geometries, model geometries, points, whether they're represented in various coordinate systems. And the key thing about having this representation for the parameters is that it can be both useful for coding, but it's also automatically used to generate the graphical user interface for the plugin for the module. So the essential process that you go through in developing one of these command line modules is to write an XML file, and here's kind of a snippet of one. And you basically say, okay, this parameter, this module is going to involve a parameter. It's an input parameter, and it's going to say it's going to be the input volume, and there's a few other tags you can use, for example, so that you get a tooltip for it. You get some other input. Then, for example, in this case, it's going to be running a Gaussian blurring filter, so you have an option to provide a variance. Now, one of the things you'll notice here is that this, for example, has a flag. It has a minus-minus variance flag, and it has a default value. So these are used both, again, like for generating the code that generates the graphical user interface, but it's also used to generate the command line interface. So looking at the corresponding C++ code, one of the things you'll see here is this line here, pound include hello slicer clp.h. That clp.h is a set of C++ code that's been automatically generated from that XML that incorporates all of the necessary parsing in order to create C++ class instances for all the parameters that have been passed to you. So this program is complete. This is an entire slicer C++ based ITK module, and it includes just this one macro invocation here, parseArgs. And parseArgs runs all of it's necessary to generate, essentially to take argc and argv and populate those classes for you. And from there, you can use those as arguments. Like, for example, here, hello slicer input volume dot cster is actually something that got passed in on the command line. And if it wasn't passed in on the command line, this parseArgs also handles all the error checking for that parsing. So it actually takes what's otherwise kind of a nasty little problem and nicely encapsulates it. But again, the other thing that's nice about it is that common XML framework allows you to both specify and parse your arguments, but it also generates the user interface. So essentially what's happening here is that when the user is in the slicer environment, they have some volumes loaded, they may have some points they've selected interactively, they can go to the user interface and say, okay, I want this input volume and I want it to go to this output volume. Slicer then converts that into the appropriate command line invocation such that your module can accept those, do some processing, and put the results back. So at kind of a top level, it gives you nice reusability and a relatively easy framework for that. Now, another extension of that, there's obviously beyond the core functionality I just described, there are a lot of variants on it that are very useful as well. One variant is that you can express those same kind of modules in the Python language and get essentially the same functionality. In this case, though, using a Python interpreter that's embedded in Slicer. So instead of having an external C++ program, you actually have a Python program. And in the same way, you define your XML, and the XML in this case is used to generate the user interface in Slicer, but it's also used, essentially corresponds to the arguments to your Python execute method in this case. Again, so a very straightforward way for people to implement their work. And like I said, there's more to it. There's a lot more variations and so forth. One of the things that's important, although I describe these as command line modules, and they are in the sense that you can run them as command lines, another thing that's sort of hidden, which is a benefit of using the conventions provided by this mechanism, is that from your CMake file, you can actually say, I not only want an executable for this program, but I also want a shared library that embeds the same functionality. Now, that shared library uses the identical C++ code. So that same piece of code that I showed you here a minute ago, even though it says main and argc and argv, through some sort of nice magic behind the scenes, that main actually is more rightly thought of as like an entry point. In the case when CMake compiles it as an executable, main means main. In the case where you've said CMake compile this as a shared library, main really means entry point. And what happens is that this module actually gets loaded into Slicer's address space, and through the some overloading of the ITK IO factory mechanism, it's essentially got direct pointer access into the data that's already in memory. So the general model, like I said, goes through files, and you can treat this as a command line. In the in the special case when things have been compiled as these sort of shared object versions, it's actually much more efficient than that because they get direct pointer access. Internally it's kind of it's kind of a detail on how it works, but it gives you kind of some nice flexibility again with a low bar to entry. And I would say just to reiterate that we encourage people who are developing algorithms which fit well with the ITK framework to take advantage of that capability. And if you're writing a filter, you're writing something that generates a surface model, and you could write it in ITK, there's very little additional work to make it a slicer module. And in fact, it's actually easier than writing your C++ code, in some other ways. I wanted to now sort of shift gears a little bit and talk about the other sort of meanings for large-scale computing. So what I've talked about so far is how we approach this sort of effort for making things compatible, how to make the software engineering side of it be kind of seamlessly integrated. Now, the next step is then to be able to apply that or deploy it in the context of large studies. And that kind of draws on some additional work that's pulled out of both the burn effort and some other efforts. So in this case, this sort of schematic shows the results of some of the work that's gone on for a number of years on the idea of collecting these multi-site data studies, which are well correlated, well calibrated, such that you can start doing multi-institution clinical studies. And there's a lot more to it than just the diagram this displays. But the essence is that burn gives you a way to take your local collections and move them into a common environment in a common data representation, such that analyses and workflows that you can run on the data can also be put back into the same repository. And that allows you to do things in terms of visualization and interpretation against that common database. And that's kind of an abstract way to talk about it, but let me give you a little bit more concrete detail on it. So the concept is the BERN data repository is a set of servers that's sponsored by the BERN. It's available really to any investigator who wants to share data. In particular, the morphometry BERN uses a tool called the Extensible Neuroimaging Archive Tool, or XNAT. Now, XNAT has been developed at the Washington University, St. Louis. It's a website front end to a very sophisticated database and workflow engine. So I'll sort of describe it that way. So the example you can see here, this is some data, the OASIS data set, which was collected by Randy Buckner and his colleagues, which is I think around 400 normal control and aging population, some of whom have dementia of various types. Very well curated, calibrated data, which is also been processed through the FreeSurfer pipeline. So there's a lot of derived data that's available through this BERN data repository, and it's a nice data set to work with for doing population studies. So in that environment, there's not only so when people often ask, well, how's this different than a PACS? Well, it's not just a set of images, it's also obviously the derived data, some of which don't fit well in a PACS, like a FreeSurfer surface file, for example, but also additional clinical data like demographics and measures for things like dementia scales, as well as analysis results, like, say, volumes of various structures. So one of the things we've implemented now as part of the BERN is the ability to do, interoperability with that data representation, the data repository, and there's an evolving effort which is showing a lot of promise called the XSEED standard, which is the XML-based clinical data exchange schema. And with that comes a set of conventions for how you describe sequences of subjects, how you bring this demographic data down to your local computing environment in a well-structured way, such that if you want to do a kind of comparison where you're trying to differentiate groups, at least you're not dealing with that sort of classic problem of having to get a spreadsheet from one person and trying to put it into some kind of format that you can type into some statistical program. I mean, hopefully this provides a much more organized way of dealing with the data. So building on that environment, we started looking also at the problem of interpreting the results, the statistical results. And so inside the slicer, one of the interactive modules that's provided is something called the Query Atlas. And this is sort of the quick description of it. It's a way that allows you to sort of go from image space back into more of a semantic description, that is, how to find literature that corresponds. It's kind of a complicated problem, so I'll actually describe it probably a little bit more in context rather than in words here. So here's kind of the picture to go along with this. The Query Atlas is essentially an annotation and web browsing interface in some ways. So the idea is that you have, this is an example of a FreeSurfer analysis that was downloaded through this XNAT interface. This is actually an FBERN example. It means it's functional data overlaid on the structural data co-registered. But the idea is that as you move your mouse around to the different parts of the image, you actually get an annotation, a real-time annotation of what structure that is. And you can say, okay, now I see this yellow blob is highly statistically significant. And as I mouse over that yellow blob, it tells me, okay, well, this is the superior frontal gyrus, or this is the temporal lobe, whatever part you're on top of. And then that one of the important parts about that, this is something that I think people often don't get to or don't think about in the context of their image analysis often, is how do you represent, how do you sort of correlate, well, I have this particular thing that I've identified, what's the actual name of that? What should I be calling it? And that's a whole problem of ontologies and how you map between structures that people have named differently. So one of the things that Byrne has done is to work on an ontology engine to map between the way FreeSurfer describes subcortical and cortical structures and the way the unified medical language system and the neuronames and the Internet Brain Volume Database and some of these other naming conventions that have been widely put forth, this idea of translating between ontologies, it's a big, almost in some ways, fundamentally unsolvable problem, but in practical small ways, it's actually a very useful thing to know that, you know, where this thing, where FreeSurfer might use, some kind of condensed CTX_6 or something, you know, you can actually find a name for that that you can actually look up in Wikipedia and get the actual definition of that structure. And then this query atlas allows you to make the link between those two things. So you click on the FreeSurfer structure and you can actually right-click and bring up a menu and say, okay, now look that up in Google, look that up in PubMed, look that up in Wikipedia, whatever thing you want, and then the browser just pops up. So that's a convenience that actually helps people like us who may not be neuroanatomists actually understand a little bit more about what's going on. So getting back to the population studies, one of the things that's been implemented in the context of this morphometry burn is to do more sophisticated statistics in the context of this rich and well-curated database and environment. So Doug Grieve and Bruce Fischel and other folks at MGH worked on something called the Query Design Estimate Contrast Tool, or QDEC, and that's been integrated into this environment such that you can actually go to the XNet database, and you can say, I'm interested in looking at the effect of aging on cortical thickness, and I want to look at it only in females who have, you know, maybe a particular dementia scaling. So you can use the searching tools built into the database in XNet to identify a subset of populations that you're interested in working with. You know, presumably those also could be filtered by what kind of analysis was run on those. Then, because the server has all that data, it has not only your search, but it also has the well-curated database, it can actually run this QDEC analysis remotely. So where you might have selected 400 subjects or 200 subjects, that can all happen on the server and condense down into something that's called a .qdec file. The .qdec file is sort of a summary description of that data. So it includes a surface representation, in this case a FreeSurfer inflated surface with an overlay that represents the statistical maps that you've requested. It runs a GLM linear model on these. And it also includes the individual subject statistics. So inside the slicer environment then, you can go through and click on individual locations. You see there's, you know, kind of a hotspot there that indicates a significant statistical region. That then can be, you can bring up then the scatter plot showing the individual subjects, and you can mouse over those and it will show you what subject you're looking at. You can identify outliers. But also these statistics that you've requested, you didn't say anything about like what anatomical region you were interested in. You just said, I wanted to know the effect of cortical thickness of this particular set of parameters. But that query atlas functionality is integrated with this so that as you mouse over these statistically significant regions, you can sort of add those to a search. So if you had now these search terms like, cortical thinning and dementia, and now you've got superior temporal gyrus, and now you've got hippocampus, all those terms are sort of assembled for you in the query atlas so that you can now go off and use those as part of your, attempt to develop some kind of scientific explanation of what might be going on, of why these elements of your research are actually related. So that's kind of the vision of it. Now, just, you know, again, that's been well sort of pioneered in that burn community. What we're working on now in the context of the XNet environment and these modules is to build the functionality so that these command line modules that are written for Slicer that are compatible with the runtime, since they're also batch compatible executables, we're actually going to also have those automatically built into XNet so that as you do queries on populations, you say, okay, now I've got this set of subjects, now invoke this module on it or invoke this sequence of modules so that then I can get, you know, sort of a round trip inside that database so that my query and my analysis results are nicely linked. So that's kind of a, you know, the population statistics story. I just want to talk a little bit more about this community issue, because a big part of making these things work well together is being able to get everybody into a common environment where they can communicate at a high level. And probably the most important thing is sort of, aside from the inherent interest and challenge, which is important, is to do, why do this sort of brain imaging, is the essence of trying to help patients, trying to translate this into something that can actually be delivered to people who can benefit from it. So I'll talk a little about what the NIH had in mind when they started some of these initiatives. They used some terminology like, you know, create a national infrastructure for computing, you know, have some support for it. When they translated this into the kind of environment they were setting up, they wanted to say things like, you know, the software should be freely available, should permit commercialization, and it should allow modifications and enhancements. So we thought about that in constructing this environment and decided that for our purposes, what really was required was a BSD style of open source software. And that's kind of a specific subset, and it's an area that we could actually spend quite a bit of time debating, I'm sure. But the idea here is to keep the base platform, you know, the fundamental pieces of it, the image reading and writing, the visualization, the core functionality for building these databases, keep that in sort of the most redeployable way possible, and have NAMIC essentially be maintaining that so that people can use it as a platform. And what we didn't want to do, and I know this is, again, something that people could discuss a lot, is to incorporate either closed software or GPL-licensed software into that core base. And if you're not familiar with what GPL is, I won't try and describe it here. But the goal really is to make it so that if people have used sort of a clean set of tools in their platform, they can build whatever they want on top of it. And that thing they build on top of it may also, you know, use some closed source software. You may talk to MATLAB. You might talk to some Siemens-specific interface on the scanner. Or you might actually build your own commercial product out of this. But, you know, you could rely on the core as being reusable in any of those ways without feeling constrained. Another thing that we really believe in is the reproducibility in the science to the extent possible. So people are encouraged to put their code and their papers into the Insight Journal. And again, that's a topic that deserves a lot more discussion than I'm going to give it now. But if you aren't familiar with it, I'd encourage you to take a look at it. So in essence, you know, you can think about a lot of these tools that I'm talking about now as essentially the public highways. And you can have driveways that go into private residences or private companies, but the actual public highways are kind of something you can rely on so that you know when you're making your other plans that you can get from point A to point B. And that's really the way we see this free software. This cartoon probably requires too much explanation to really be a useful cartoon, but the idea is that, you know, we have a lot of folks here who belong with the group on the left as brilliant scientists who have a lot to deliver, and the question is sort of how to get it to those other groups on the right, those patients who need it. And what we found is empirically, you know, if there are restrictions, let's say that you come up with an algorithm, but it requires a little bit from here and here and here, and everybody's got a little different licensing term, and some people's code requires you to distribute all your code if you improve on it, and other people's code is only for research use but not for commercial. You end up with a sort of mix of licensing schemes and code that kind of keeps everything in the science domain but doesn't allow you to get it to the patients. And so that's where this idea that the NAMIC kit is kind of a conduit to get it something that could still be compatible with the FDA, which is another big topic, but actually could be put into routine clinical practice. Actually, some of the folks on this list are actually here, Guido and others. And so, you know, again, this is just a visual representation of the fact that we have a lot of really great contributors to this effort. And again, just sort of in the interest of time, I'll go a little quickly through this, but there's a lot of opportunities for both electronic and in-person meetings, and I'll just show you some pictures of this sort of thing. So there's actually Guido and Alan Tannenbaum, whose presence is felt even if he's not here, and if some other folks you may know. We get together yearly for an all-hands meeting, which is open to the public. We also get together for programming events where people are encouraged to come and just sort of sit and work, as opposed to present their work, but sit and actually work in groups. So this last month, for a week, we had 120 people at MIT, literally dozens of different projects, all working in this common environment. Now, you can't really see here, but you know, it's basically a big room, bigger, you know, maybe two or three times the size of this room, with a bunch of tables set up. Everybody gets a place for their laptop. And the idea is that you sit down and you work on things that really require you to communicate closely with some of the other developers. And you really need to understand how the CMake file is set up, or why ITK requires you to use this particular template structure in order to be compatible across multiple platforms. And it's a great opportunity to work those things out for people who otherwise would be working in isolation. Another big element of this is to capture a lot of those best practices into training materials and information that both presented face-to-face but also is collected on the website. So, for example, just also last month, a group of us went to Munich. We had two-day presentations which involved hands-on, people actually sort of not only sort of following along and using the software to run tasks, but also writing command line modules, plugging them in, seeing how that works, kind of learning the infrastructure. We're going to hold a bunch more of those in the next couple months at a number of sites. And since, you know, I think this is approximate, but there's certainly been over 1,000 people since 2004 who've been involved in these kind of training events. So it's been a pretty nice activity to have NIH funding specifically to encourage people to do software engineering and to learn about what's available to them and prevent this reinventing the wheel. So again, like I say, we capture these as much as we can on the wiki with both the data. Again, we try and give everything you need. Here's the instructions. Here's the the step-by-step how you do this work. Here's the data that you can use to go step through it. And here's the source code from start to finish, everything involved. If you want to tweak it and try and improve the algorithm, improve the result, that's great. You're going to be received with open arms for doing that. So I couldn't go through all this great stuff without pointing out a few of the downsides, and I'm sure that people can point out even more, you know, if they think about it. But, you know, in a lot of ways, this kind of community has two good, you know, it's like any internet community or whatever, right? There's the wisdom of the crowds. Wikipedia is great, but, you know, on the other hand, you know, you have Wikipedia editors who don't let people, you know, put certain opinions on, and you have the sort of design by committee results sometimes when you have software or other things. So, you know, you can either look at whichever side you want. I think, you know, in net result, it's very, very positive. It's been a great experience. So opportunities, if people are interested, we're going to have another, we have this Project Week thing twice. We have once in the winter in Salt Lake City, so there's a nice skiing overlap opportunity if you want. We don't have the exact dates yet, but it'll be in January. And then in the summer at MIT, it's always nice to get together there. We don't have the exact dates, but it'll be sometime in June. And also, there is another mechanism from these NIH National Centers for Biomedical Computing, which is that there are opportunities for collaboration grants. So if people have software, for example, that they, you know, maybe that's already a good fit, maybe a lot of it's written in ITK, they're looking for a way to sort of put it into a framework so that it could be, you know, more widely distributed, or work with the community, work with specific individuals in NAMIC, there's an R01 mechanism specifically, you know, sort of flagged out for collaborating. And there have been a couple that have already gone through and been funded. They've been really, really effective at developing the software and moving some things forward we really would have had no other way of doing. So I hope this all made sense. That's kind of a big picture view of a lot of different threads, but it's kind of, the goal is it's an end-to-end platform where you can sort of say, okay, I know now how all the pieces are supposed to work. I know how my clinical collaborator is going to get the image. I know where the data is going to go when it comes off the scanner, and I know where to put my algorithm, and I know that I don't have to train them how to pan and zoom in the image because there's already a tutorial for that. It's completely open source, really reusable. You just pick and choose. If you only want some of the ITK classes, you can do that. If you want to use the whole thing, anything is possible. But I think what's really impressed me a lot in getting together at these meetings, you get 120 people, they're all working on essentially very similar stuff. And when they say, okay, I didn't, you know what to do for, how do I use this 3D widget in VTK to set up a point that I can move around, everybody knows what they're talking about and can help out, and you know, the experts are available, and that's an amazingly powerful thing. So there's just a few more links for more information.
Questions for Steve?
I wonder if you can say something about whether you've come upon any strategies for overcoming the sort of not invented here phenomenon.
Well, I think, I mean, it's a big point, and I think it's often like a really valid feeling that, like, I know this environment, I've worked on it, I can get done what I need to get done. And I think there's nothing wrong with that in terms of encouraging diversity of approaches, because, you know, you want to, you know, it shouldn't be a monoculture of everyone does things the same way. But, you know, I think what we're encouraging, and I think that's why this NITRIC effort that I mentioned is so important, is that when people make contributions, it doesn't become sort of subsumed into this, you know, bland generic, it's all, you know, one thing. You can actually, it's based on SourceForge. So if you're familiar with the idea that you can have your own project page, your project page can have its own web page and wiki and source code repository, you know, essentially any module or any piece of code that's contributed to this environment can actually have a life of its own and actually be, you know, have multi-targets. So if you say, well, okay, I developed this infrastructure for doing, you know, you name it kind of analysis, you know, you can have ITK classes that you develop that are available from your website together with mailing lists if people have questions about them. And frankly, I think not only is that important for people to get the credit they deserve, but it's important for, it's really the only way for this kind of stuff to be able to scale, the only way that you can actually sort of do a significant or a meaningful amount of work, you know, without, you know, just getting bogged down.
Any other questions?